accession number 4638, reel number 3.
This is tape number 3, Mr. Scheuer. And Mr. Scheuer, we left you stranded on the Andamans and Nicobar.
That's right. The batteries I was up to, where they had to be returned to the base. Now, there's a certain way which this had to be done. They'd already been used. So in order to transport them safely and properly, they had to be fully charged and then drained of the acid and washed out then with distilled water and then packed away and sent back and crated and sent back to the base, and where and they were labelled as what had been done, and they would then have to be reactivated by being refilled with the correct acid, correct gravity, and charged up again and brought into use. That was the correct method to transport them. There was one incident there which stuck out very much so. I was draining these one battery in particular in an open drain, which there's a lot of there, but it was like half a big pipe that lay on the ground as it was in the dockyard, and I was quite keen watching this acid run out and making sure that I didn't get any of it on me, and I heard somebody go, "He's sissing at me from around." I looked up, and because there was an office quite near me, a native was looking out of the window, and his eyes were rolling, and he looked at me, and he went like moving sideways, you see, and so I looked to see what he was looking at, and there was a cobra coming along this drain towards me. So I eased away, I left the battery, and then I beat like hell out of the road. I never found out what happened to that cobra, but if he'd gone into the acid, he'd be very sorry for himself. So that was the end of that. We did get the battery eventually and packed it up, and we all turned to, all the rest of the ground staff, packed all our things away, including Johnny the cook, and got ready to make sail back to Rangoon. The Shah Jahan had called in at Port Blair, ready for us, and we loaded up, and away we went. We went back to Rangoon, spent a few days there at Sale Barracks. We stopped, which was the army barracks, just by the Shwe Dagon Pagoda, which we visited, of course, and most interesting, because we had to take our shoes off as well before you went in there. And as you went up a series of steps to enter the main courtyard where all these Buddhas and temples were around, there were cripples of every description and flies on them, and it was quite sickening to pass this lot. It made it quite authentic. And we went around this courtyard and had a look at all the different things they had, marble Buddhas and brass ones, presumably gold plated or something, and the dome itself was like a gold plated, and the top was encrusted with jewels. And I remember on one occasion a pilot said, "If I got a plane I could circle that and knock the top off," which of course would make him very rich if he got away with it. From Rangoon we sailed straight back, picked the boat up practically straight away, and off we went back to Singapore and Salita and rejoined the squadron. Now, the time is coming up for our air gunnery exercises, and it had arrived at the competition time. Us air gunners in those days, we did more than just fire guns. We had to do a certain amount of navigating, because we had to do bomb aiming and bomb dropping, of course. We had carried no separate bomb aimers. We did the lot in that sort of line. And during this competition, a young chap came up to me, who was a rigger, and he didn't normally fly. He flew when he could, but normally he was a ground rigger. And he asked me if I'd care to swap places with him. Now, a wireless operator's place on flying boats, those flying boats, was always up in the bows to start with, because he was responsible for slipping the boy or picking up the boy or any other duty that wanted doing up there, dropping the anchor, things like that. And he asked, so my position would have been to fire from the bows, which gives you a good arc of fire when you're firing at the ground. And he was an absolutely keen as mustard boy. I think it was an apprentice. He was either an apprentice or a boy. He was one of the cream of the Air Force and would have no doubt gone to high rank. So I said, no, I didn't mind at all that I'd fire from midships, which had a smaller arc of fire. You had to watch your wingtip float, you didn't shoot that off, or shoot a lump off your tail, so you were confined. And we carried on with this exercise, and it all went all right, so far as we were concerned. And after we'd finished, we started off back for base, and we were going across the corner of the island of Singapore, where Changi is. We just hopped over Changi, and as we got over it, we started to lose height, which didn't worry us very much. We were losing height in a normal sort of way, although we were still flying. And we got lower and lower, and I thought, well, I don't know whether the pilot's trying to give us a thrill or what, because they would do this if they thought you were getting a kick out of it. I wasn't. And we still seemed to be getting lower and drifting a bit across the water, and the water was like glass, the surface of the water. And whilst I was beginning more puzzled than ever, and I was about to go forward or look to see what was doing, we actually hit the water. We'd flown onto it, and the engines were still going at flying speed, and we were flying in it, into the water. So the float on my side, starboard side, dipped into the water, and as it dipped, all the pressure was coming on it to slow the aircraft up, and there's a terrific splitting and a crack as the main spar went, bottom main spar in the wing, and you could feel the whole thing breaking up. And at that moment, I felt water rush up around my feet, and the next thing was, I was flying through the air and into the sea. As I came up, the aircraft was upside down, facing the opposite way, we had somersaulted, its back was broken, and there was oil and my flying helmet and logs floating away on the sea, and I couldn't see anybody. And I thought, this is it. The log had been bumped up by the look of it. So I climbed up onto the fuselage, cutting myself doing it. And as I did so, I saw the pilot swimming from quite a way off. How he got there, I'd never know, because the arc that he was in was only a small one, so he may have gone under the water, and he probably swam under the water to get clear of anything, because I remember as I came up, I put my hand on my head in case a prop hit me, thinking something might hit me. So I saw that he was all right, and he was swimming quite well towards the boat, and there was still no sign of the other three members of the crew. There was the rigger who took my place in the front, and there was the fitter who sat behind the pilot, and there was another rigger who'd come up for just a flight, and he was sitting on my wireless seat inside when this had happened. And I heard him call out, "Sam," which was my nickname, Sam, get me out. And I knew he couldn't swim. Now a non-swimmer won't put his head under the water if he can possibly help it. So I got back into the water and shoved my head through the cockpit, which was underwater, and said, "Take a deep breath and put your legs through, and I'll get you from outside, and don't worry." Which he did. I got out, and he came through, and I managed to get an arm around him, and get him. We were close up to the fuselage anyway, And by this time the pilot had dropped in to see if he could help. And between us, we just pushed him up onto the broken wreck there. I took my shirt off, gave it to him, and I said, if you see anybody, wave this shirt and get them over. I said, there's a fisherman over there for a start. Get him over here for a start. So I said, and I'm going back to have another look to see if I can find the other two. And because I had to go over the front end, the pilot went one side and I went the other, and there was nothing but a mass of broken props and engine and oil and petrol and bits of metal and crushed aircraft. And you couldn't see anything. It was too mucky by this time. But I did feel my way around it and try and locate where the cockpits were. But you couldn't. There was nothing there. It was all crushed in. So I came back again and got back on the fuselage with this other chap. And as I did so, I said, well, there we are. Is the other flying boat just going over to take over from us to do his AFR in? And I knew from our own experience what we did that somebody would be looking over the side. And I said, now wave my shirt, which he did do. And he waved my shirt and I could almost see the bloke looking out over the side, you see. And he saw this and he must have nipped up to the pilot, Hughes Halley, to tell him. And he did a steep bank and came right down on the water. Now, as they got down, they asked us to swim across to them, you see. And I said, well, we can't do that because this other chap couldn't swim. So he taxied, and he taxied his bows just up to our bows that were the crushed parts, and we could step from our aircraft into his. And we did, got inside, and they opened up their first aid kit, and he left one of his riggers behind with his native fisherman to guard, watch the aircraft and in case anything happened, you see, and said he would send help. And we took off straight away and off we went, returned to base. And when he returned to base, I expect he got a bit of a kick out of it, but he fired a Veery cartridge, the red Veery cartridge, and you could see action all round on the base. There was ambulances coming down and motorboats were coming out and everybody was looking out of the offices. We got down on the water and went straight to the buoy and moored up on the short strop. And the MT section came alongside, and we got out, walking wounded as it were, into the boat, and he took us ashore to the jetty. Now, I looked a mess because I'd got no shirt on and I've got a very hairy tummy as well. My stockings had gone and shoes, and wireless operators in those days used to have indelible pencils and they worn down the stocking. So I had blood dripping from me where I'd got one or two cuts, and this indelible stuff would have legs. And I walked up, and the pilot had to be helped. He'd got a great lump of flesh gouged from the calf of his leg, and he was helped by the other chap, the other crew member who wasn't damaged. He'd got a bruise or two, but nothing at all really. And somebody from the other aircraft. And there was we went straight down into the hangar, and I went into the office, and the others just disappeared somewhere. And an ambulance came up, and one of my mates who'd come back, who'd taken my place at the Andamans, nipped along to the office and asked me how I was, and got kicked out for his trouble by somebody who didn't want me saying anything to anybody. And got me in the ambulance and took me up to our own sick quarters.
It sounds rather as if you took over the rescue operation. Did you get any recognition for the part you played?
Yes. It happened while I was in hospital, really, recovering from this. The Air Ministry were informed, and a letter came from the Air Council, which I didn't see, but apparently the whole squadron were paraded, and a letter of commendation for gallantry was read out from the Air Council towards me and this pilot.
Oh, very nice.
Yes. And that was that. The next thing after, we went to Changi for just the two of us, the chap who I'd pulled out myself, to have a recovery period. We were there for about a fortnight, I suppose. And then we returned to squadron for normal duties. And one of the first duties I had was to go up with a sergeant pilot who was particularly good. And he'd obviously been given the tip, like they do in the Air Force, I don't know if it still applies, to see how, if your nerve had cracked.
Yes, sir.
We flew as low as possible over the water, with me up in the bows, which was the fatal position for the other chap. But he just skimmed the water with his float and the fuselage, and I died a thousand deaths. I had my hands on the cockpit, and I know I was gripping and banging it with my fists, and I was calling him all the bees under the sun. But it didn't break me. I stuck it because I knew the pilot was good, and his flying, I could appreciate his flying quite easily. I knew he'd got full control. So that was that. We finished the trip, and we went back. Nobody said anything to me of any description about what this was doing, but it was obviously what it was for, to see how I stood it. And that was that. And we went back to the hangar and finished for the day, and then we carried on our normal routine for the rest of my time in Singapore. There was nothing really outrageous happened during that. Oh, apart from various searches we used to go on. One was for Mrs. Bonney, who was doing the England-Australia flips that were going on in those days, the 30s, late 20s and early 30s. And she was reported, she was cousin of Bert Hinkler. Was it Bert Hinkler?
Yeah.
And she'd got lost. It had been reported that she was lost, which was quite a common occurrence on that trip. And we were alerted. It was on a Sunday morning. I was lying on my bed having a crafty kip like all good airmen do. And the flight sergeant came in and he said, "Right, you sure you get out, you're flying." So we went straight down to the hangar and I said, what's cooking? And he said, "There's an aviator missing on this day, and you've got to go up with your radio and keep contact." And that was it. Off we went. We took off in no time at all, it seemed, and started going up the coast. And I think we got as far as Penang, and we decided we'd better stop and check up things here. So we alighted at Penang and moored up to a buoy, and out came the Shell agent with his boat, petrol, if we wanted anything. And he let us know that the Mrs. Bonney had been found. She'd forced landed on a stretch of beach, and she'd been found and been taken back to Rangoon, I think it was. So that was one thing that was finished.
Were there any other interesting things from the wireless point of view?
Wireless, of course, was very much misunderstood. In fact, it wasn't understood at all by pilots, or very few pilots. One of the things that I was engaged on, which turned out to be the beginnings of a successful event, was direction finding. I loved the direction finding, the prospects in it. And what we did, we had an aerial which wound the whole length of the plane, the wing itself, if you like, around the top and around the bottom and into the radio equipment inside, and also one that went around the sort of width of the plane that went inside. Now, you must remember that there was no intercommunication, so this made things very difficult. But we went up, we got airborne and went out into the China Sea specifically for this job. And what I did was to call up the base and ask them to transmit on a certain frequency and to press the key for so long. Now, whilst they did this, I tuned my equipment to the transmission, and also I waved to the fitter who was sitting near the pilot's feet to tell the pilot to turn either one way or the other. And as he turned, and I still had this note on, I would receive the transmission on the aerial, which was a loop, really, around the aircraft. And I could get a mean bearing. That is, as the aerial swung, the you'd get a mean, what they call a mean bearing. That is, at certain angles to the transmission, the signal would be faded right out. It's the property of aerials. If an aerial is placed in a certain position, the what we call the EMS, or the voltages induced in that aerial, would cancel each other. It would be received on a whole frame, and they would run around the similar way and cancel each other out. This is a theory of it. And turning it back again, and I could bring in this extra aerial, which would give me sense. So that once I got the bearing of the aerial, of the transmission, irrespective of anything else, I wouldn't know whether I was on the true bearing of the station or its reciprocal. So by bringing in this extra aerial, it would either aid or not aid either that side or that side, whichever I switched it. And by so doing, I achieved sense, that I'd got a louder signal there than I did there. So therefore, that must be my bearing, and that's the reciprocal. And in which case, I'd pass a chit up to the pilot. All this is taking time. Nowadays, it's done like that, you see. And pass it up to the pilot, and he would then fly on this. Now, he was interested, although he didn't fully understand or quite sure, but he flew on that bearing, but he didn't allow for wind. And the consequence was the aircraft gradually drifted round and round into the wind, and I took more bearings, so that it finished up that we aircraft had moved right round the spot because of the wind drift, but nevertheless it finished up heading straight downwind, or straight into wind rather, towards the station, which was an advantage if you didn't know where you were, because you were upwind for landing as well. Following this, there was another experiment by a Corporal Cherrington, who was an electrical instrument maker type of man, and he was very quiet and very clever, and he seemed to start the auto gyro. He had a gyro wheel which was controlled by pressure from a wind-driven pump on the wing of the aircraft, which was driven in turn from a slipstream from the prop. This supplied his pressure, and I didn't know much about it except that this is what it was. George, as we know it, I don't know if we still know it as George. And when he put this gadget into action, connected it up, the difference was amazing. You could tell it immediately that something had taken over. The aircraft's shaky movements up and down, sideways, finished. It was a smooth, perfect flight. And as soon as it took it out again and the pilot took over, it became like a jerky bus. And I'm quite sure must have been one of the beginnings of the automatic pilot.
What was the next step in your service life?
Well, we've soon finished our tour at Singapore, and I was posted then to the Middle East, to Palestine. I was posted to Jerusalem, and we had a sort of large house there in which we were billeted, and from the house we'd go up the main street to our headquarters near the King David's Hotel, where we had our wireless equipment. I was only there about a week with two other chaps who'd come with me, and we were attached to Ramleh, or detached to Ramleh, which is nearly at Tel Aviv, well on the way from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. And there I remained until I finally returned home. Whilst there, which was 1934, I was ground crew, ground operating most of the time, and doing considerable work. We could do up to 80 to 100 messages in a morning, which was quite good going. It meant fast work and good cooperation, no mucking about with arguing the point. And I worked with Jerusalem itself and with Amman, and any outs, small out stations, or we'd work with Helio or anything like that.
Was there some sort of air headquarters at Jerusalem?
Yes. Yes, air headquarters was at Jerusalem. AHQ PNTJ, that's AHQ Palestine Transjordan. And because they were responsible for all the air action in Palestine. The life there was pretty good. Plenty of sun. There was various things you could belong to. But it was still limited because there's an Arab village just outside Ramleh, and the buses used to run to Tel Aviv, but we weren't all that welcome in Tel Aviv. So apart from that, we were left to much of our own devices. We could swim. We had a swimming pool on the camp, which was actually an emergency fire pool that I learnt to qualify for my life-saving or life-saving certificate and medal from there by this swimming pool. And then, of course, along within a year or two, 1936, and we were in trouble. This is when the Arabs and Jews really started getting down to it. It happened that I went out on that first day that the trouble really struck us with my pal, and we were in civvies. We had on our pork pie hats because we wanted to look something like the boys in Tel Aviv after the girls. And on this bus, there were Arabs who had guns with them. Well, this was fairly normal. Well, not too normal, but it was acceptable. And one of them said to me, he said, take your hat off, in broken English, of course, and, you know, hide it. So I said, my mate, yeah, I said, this is what he told me. So we said, well, you know, we'll do this. We took our hats off and put them under the seat. On that bus was a warrant officer and his wife as well. Off we went along the road then, and we got down to past Palestine General Hospital, the RAF Palestine General Hospital at Sarafand, and then we passed a police post. Now, as we passed this police post, on the side of the road there was a car upside down and it was flaming, and I thought, my goodness, it's been an accident. So the bus eased up and we sort of peer out to see what happened, and there was a body stretched alongside and it was badly damaged. And before we could turn around to get back to our seats, there was a whole crowd came out both sides of the road, and they were all Arabs of all descriptions, you see, and they were looking absolutely uncontrollable, and particularly the women, and their eyes were sticking out and just about frosting at the mouth, and they had great rocks and sticks, and they came over to the bus, and the women were glaring through the windows, and I could feel something sticking in my back just about. But I thought to myself, this is it. You with this body along the side. So I got up and I walked down the front. I was going to get hold of the driver, do something. And as I did, a big Nubian, I call him a Nubian because he was like a great big black fellow. Didn't look nothing like an Arab, but a big black fellow. And he got on there with his eyes, and he had a knife in his hand, and he was coming towards me. And he said, Yehudi. And I said, I got mad by this time. I was really cross. I said, Mush, Yehudi, Inglesi, RAF. And he looked at me, stared at me, and said, ah, Inglesi. And he held up both hands, and he turned round and whipped all the others off that were coming on behind him. And as he got off and got away from the bus started to drive away. And I said, go on, George. Iggery, iggery. So he moved on a bit faster. We'd gone about, 75 yards, and the same thing happened again. Out comes the crowd from the orange groves and the bushes, the hedges, with the same racket, with their bricks and knives. And as I thought, well, I don't know if I can get away with it this time. And while I was thinking this, I heard a noise from behind, and I looked back, and another Jew was coming along in his car. He'd seen what had happened. He couldn't turn back, and he drove straight into them. Straight into them. And as he drove into them, the bodies went up against the bus, out in the road. And I said, I looked back, And there were bodies all over the road, and they were groaning, holding their legs, their heads, arms, but they were leaving us alone. So I went up and I prodded the driver, and he, "Go on, George." And he got him to move off. He was a bit reluctant, but he moved off. And another quarter of a mile, and we reached Jaffa, which is the Arab village. We turned Jaffa corner, and then at the next corner, which was roughly 100 yards, 150 yards, 200 yards, was the Jaffa police post, which was manned by British Palestine policemen. And they were out armed and patrolling, and they said to us, "Get in the police post and stay."